Hello and welcome to Minter Dialogue, episode number 413. My name is Minter Dial and I'm your host for this podcast. First, I'd like to give out a shout out and thanks for putting up a 5-star review of the show to Sarah Fries on iTunes. Please consider to do the same, drop in your rating and review, and don't forget to subscribe to catch all the future episodes. This week's interview is with the lovely Mark Schaefer. Mark is a globally recognized keynote speaker, educator, business consultant, and author. His blog, Grow, is perennially considered as one of the top marketing blogs in the world. His latest book, which happens to be his 9th, is a keeper. Cumulative Advantage: How to Build Momentum for Your Ideas, Business, and Life Against All Odds, which explores the art and science of momentum with great storytelling and verve. In this chat with Mark, we discuss key elements of his book, how individuals and companies can accumulate the right mix for their advantage, and how the book gels with Mark's deeper purpose. You'll find all the show notes on MinterDial.com. Now for the show. Mark Schaefer! Great to have you back. It's been way too long. I mean, you are such a maestro, monster of content creation.
I've never heard that. That's a good one. A monster of content creation. I may try to use that somewhere. Thank you. It's such a delight. This has been on my calendar and I've been watching this date. I said, I can't wait. This is going to be amazing talking to you.
Well, so not only a monster, because you could just, you know, roll out a lot of shit, but you roll out things that provoke, and you have that nasty habit of actually making me need to read your stuff.
Oh, that's the highest compliment. It really is. Well, you know, I take writing books extremely seriously. I've earned an audience who knows that I will not let them down, that this is a no fluff book. There's ideas and inspiration on every page. And so, Minter, when I wrote this book, I only had one goal. It had to be better than my last book. And I mean, it was hard. This was a really, really, really hard book to write. Probably my most difficult angst-ridden book.
Where did that angst come from?
Well, a couple of places. Number one, I started writing this book in the summer of 2019. And then the world turned upside down. We had political just division and toxicity. We had social justice protests in the streets. And then we had a pandemic. And I had written a few chapters by then, and I sent them to a friend. I think it was maybe April of 2020. And I said, is this still a book? And he wrote me a message back, capital YES, with 3 exclamation points. He said, not only is this a book, this is going to be your legacy. This is your best book. So that sort of gave me the power and the energy to keep going. And then, but I think as I got into it, as you know from the book, this is sure. It's a business book. It's probably the closest I've come to a self-help kind of book. It applies to people. It applies to businesses. It applies to every kind of organization. However, it also applies to our society. And as I was writing the book, I could not ignore this. I just couldn't ignore the fact that there are undertones in this book that are relevant to some of the chaos going on in our world. And so I decided in the last chapter of the book that I would address this in a personal way. And it was really hard. It took me 3 months to write that one chapter. I had all these different people looking at it from all these different perspectives. And it was a big risk because it's not the sort of narrative that you would typically hear from a middle-aged white guy. And I had to sort of shed this role of what I'm supposed to say what I'm supposed to think in this world and say, look, if I don't say these things, I'd be, I would be a coward. These things have to be said, so I'm going to say them. And the reception has been really good. So it was hard. It was just a really, really hard book to write. But it's people love it. And so in that way, it's been worth the effort and it's been very rewarding.
It's dotted with great stories. And of course, that last chapter, I'm sure that amongst the people you asked to check it out was Elijah.
Yes. and his grandmother.
Sure, the Titan. Well, I can't remember the name you used for her, but
yeah.
There are two things that were swirled around in my head as I read that chapter. Firstly, I can relate to moving from just a pure business book to life and the self-help thing. And I don't know if you've been finding your book actually ranking in Amazon self-help categories.
Yeah. Yeah, it ranked in, this surprised me. It ranked in like job hunting or something like that. I thought, well, okay. I mean, I'll take whatever they give me. But that was sort of unusual.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know Jeff Bullis or not.
Sure.
Jeff. I had a conversation with Jeff the other night and he read the book and he said, this is a good book for business. It's a good book for marketing. He said, but this is a book that teaches you how to be a better human being. And I thought that was sort of an interesting new way to describe my book that I appreciated.
Mm. So philosophically, I wanted to start with talking about capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of under fire. There's this notion of the rich get richer and the poor. Yes. There's this divide going on.
Yeah.
And what is your foundational belief with regard to capitalism? Because how does that instruct or inform the way you write?
Well, let's put it this way. It's my philosophy is definitely in transition. I mean, I grew up as a capitalist pig dog. I worked for a Fortune 100 company. My role in life was to make the quarterly numbers, to fight for the quarterly numbers, higher profits every quarter without excuse, without end. And as there was a signature moment for me that started me thinking in a different way. It was probably about 8 years ago at South by Southwest. And I would challenge myself to go to sessions that were just push me in a different way. And I think this was 8, maybe 9 years ago. And one of the sessions was something about we shouldn't be in business to make money. And I thought, oh boy, what kind of an idiot is given a talk like this?
How can this go well?
I thought, oh, this is going to be rich. So I listened to him. And for the first time, it really challenged me and some of my notions. And of course, we've had businesses like Patagonia, purpose-driven, values-driven businesses around for a long time. But he was really suggesting a new sort of corporation that was built around values and purpose. And I think what's happening right now is that when we have such a concentration of money and power, and so many people are being left behind, the real value, I think, of traditional capitalism has to be questioned. And I'll just use this as an example, is that if you look at these reports that they do about happiness, wellness in different countries in the world, generally speaking, they have a GDP that's sort of in the middle of the pack. And that the richer companies, more capitalist countries, sort of have lower happiness scores and lower even life expectancy and so forth. And As you know from the book, I've spent a good portion of my last 13 years working in inner city communities, in economically deprived communities with economically challenged families. And it's like they're the whole community, every life in this community is on the edge. It's so fragile. They're one broken car away from crisis. They're one leaky roof away from disaster. And there's just so many people, you know, being left behind. So I think it is time to rethink. And as I said, my philosophy is really in transition as I'm trying to figure this out myself.
Hmm. I had it for later, but it does feel like we need to talk about what is success. You were talking about with your book that your measurement is to do better than the one before. Mm-hmm. When we are in running a company, we can aim for a number, 10 million, 100 million, number yeah. one. And then the question is, well, is that what it's all about?
Yeah.
Which tends to be what the markets are looking for, you know, the capital markets.
Well, back in my corporate pig dog days, I was in a training class, and it was one of these, I was working on a master's degree, actually, in applied behavioral sciences. And so this teacher was going around the class, and we were supposed to be talking about our feelings and our concerns. And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Well, Mark, what's the feeling that you experience most of the time?" And it was easy. I said, "Anxiety." I said, "What else could it be? I've got this high pressure job and a high pressure company. And instead of doing what I'm supposed to be doing, I'm sitting in this class." And I was sort of a smartass. And I turned to this instructor and I said, "Well, what's the feeling you feel most of the time?" He said, "Joy." And I looked in his eyes and I knew it was true. And from that moment on, I had a new goal for my life. In fact, I've got the word joy right over my shoulder here on my desk, because I thought, what am I living for? Why? I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful to experience joy as the predominant feeling in your life? Isn't that what we should all be aiming for? And I was, you know, I was young and climbing up the corporate ladder, but from that moment on, I started making decisions that led to joy instead of leading to advancement or money or whatever. And I've had a great career, don't get me wrong. And I'm financially, I'm fine. But I've also, over the years, I've left a lot of money on the table and a lot of opportunities. I actually talk about it in the new book, don't I?
Yeah.
So that's Tim Ferriss. Yeah. So that's really, I guess I would have been about 30, maybe something like 30 years old when I started making that change in my life. And so I feel good about things right now.
So I started mine at around 37. And I wanted to just do a shout out to a friend of mine called Rod Banner, because he started the group with a kind of a community feel and a mission. The name of his group, which is quite large, at least in Britain, is called Joy Tech. How can we exploit technology to bring more joy to the world? Not just the happy ha ha ha, but the joy, fulfillment, deep satisfaction elements. And the connecting of dots that I have is that we're old geezers. And on top of that, all three of us are white men, mm-hmm. been around the block. And then the challenge is for the corporate ladderists and the people starting out to move from the, "Oh, well, I've got to pay the mortgage. I've got to do certain things. My father wants me to be a doctor," or pressure from society.
Right.
And to make that switch. So you made it at 30, which is reasonably young in the grand scheme of things. I made it maybe at 37, but it certainly wasn't an overnight switch. It was like, "Oh, this is the beginning of my journey." It's the way I write it now.
Of course.
How do we encourage more of that type of switch and search for joy when we have the stock market and VCs and private equity sharks that are still looking for the number?
Well, first, I guess something that's different about me is that I don't necessarily want to evangelize my choices. I honor whatever choices people make. I don't know what their situation is. It's like you say, I mean, people have a mortgage to pay. They have hungry children to feed. Maybe they made a bad financial decision and they need to recover from that. Maybe they've got a parent who needs expensive procedures. And so they're working very, very hard. I don't dismiss the fact that in some respects, it takes a certain amount of luxury to be able to make a decision that says I'm going to live my life more toward joy. Certainly, my ancestors couldn't make that decision, and yours probably couldn't either. You know, my heritage, my grandfather, he was a plumber, and he worked really, really hard, just scraping by. But so I don't begrudge anybody. I don't really judge anybody. I do think there's a certain toxicity about the hustle culture, that really this idea of just hours being worked is somehow glorified. You know, this is absent, oh, I'm trying to do something good for my family, or I need to repay these debts, but I've talked to people, it's like, oh my gosh, they're ruining their lives because they just have this emphasis on the number of hours worked. It's almost like a competition or something. And that does make me sad because there doesn't, and there's just so many people sort of failing in that realm, and they're losing their families. They're losing relationships. But you asked, you know, how do we do it? At the top of my blog, it has three words. It says marketing, strategy, humanity. And most of my blog posts are about the amazing, wonderful, ever fascinating world of marketing and business. But I also love just looking at how this impacts humanity. And basically, for the last decade or so, I've tried to do everything I can to insert more humanity into that equation and encourage people and nurture people and coach people who are trying to work their way through this. My last book before Cumulative Advantage was Marketing Rebellion, The Most Human Company Wins, which is, you know, a wake-up call, I hope, and it has started a bit of a movement to encourage people to think about, you know, let's get away from our dashboards. Let's get away from this addiction to our MarTech stack and really get back in touch with what marketing is supposed to be. It's about building an emotional connection to what you do. And that's why marketing is lost, because we're trying to cut costs and move everything to algorithms. And that's not what people want today.
When you talk about Tim Ferriss's story, clearly, he had that kind of a wake-up moment in his life, breaking up with his girlfriend, doing the trip around the world that allowed him to do it. And it feels, certainly for me, because that's the way my wake-up call was, I needed a life-changing moment. Mm-hmm. Say, uh-oh, well, all that's just a bunch of baloney. You know, we got to do something that matters, something that's more meaningful. And even though many people need to put food on the plate, kind of feeling, there is this daunting risk that the hard work ends out with burnout.
Yeah.
And so there still needs to be, I feel, up and down the scale, some kind of attachment to something that provides you with an extra energy, because to keep on learning and figuring out the new marketing stack, like you're saying, and the new tech thing and this and that, and shifting all that energy you need to keep up with the Joneses, something needs to keep driving you. And if we don't enable that, or at least give permission to people to feel that.
Well, certainly it's been that way for me. And what a disorienting experience I had when the pandemic hit. And I got the disease early on. And one of the aspects of my illness was that I had hypoxia. So I wasn't getting enough oxygen to my brain. I couldn't think. I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I couldn't concentrate on anything for about 3 weeks. And it was sort of early on. And then when I kind of get out of this haze, Minter, well, my business had crashed, right? So I was a speaker without an audience and a teacher without classes and a consultant without customers. And so my, like the furnace was cold. This, what's going to be driving me? And what is that heart? What is that passion? And what I realized was that I'm a teacher. I'm a teacher in everything I do, whether I speak or write or consult. But the world just needed me to teach something else right now. And once I got that reorientation to think about, okay, this is really who I am, and this is how I apply myself in this moment, that was very helpful.
It's beautiful. What strikes me is this notion of purpose.
Yeah.
And it took me a while to come up with mine. And you write in one of your chapters, this notion of the constancy of purpose.
Yeah.
How do you like to define purpose? Just where does it go in your mind?
Wow, that's a big question. For me, you know, I just think for me, I'm at this amazing place. I went through a lot of reflection in the last few years because I find myself looking into the last third of my life. And when you're in your 30s or 40s, you can make choices to do something and you've got a lot of room for error. You can always pivot and try something else. And now I'm looking into the last third of my life and I want to get excited about something. I want to wind something up. I don't want to wind something down. So I went on a hike with a friend and he said, well, look where you are right now. How do you know that this isn't the beginning, that this is just the beginning of your journey? See, I look at it as, oh my gosh, I've come so far. And what he's seeing it a different way. He said, you still have so far to go. Why in the world would you stop? And this was a great perspective to hear because I'm in this amazing position where every week someone tells me, writes me, sends me a note and says, you changed my life. You helped my business. And look, 20 years ago, I would have thought my life to be amazing if I would have heard that one time in my whole life. I changed my life. I'll never forget a few years ago, I was at a conference in Scotland and this young woman came up to me and she had tears in her eyes and she said, I am who I am because of you, because you've taken the time to listen to me and help me and answer my questions and I read all your books. And so why would I stop that? I mean, that's a pretty great purpose. That, you know, that's really the most amazing purpose you could ever dream of. And so where I'm sort of dedicated right now is how, if I can have that sort of positive impact on people, how can I scale that to be even more? My inspiration is Brené Brown. Brené, she is like, she does it on her terms. She's brilliant. She's kind. She's insightful. She's inspiring. She doesn't really compromise. Her personality, her being just comes through in such a powerful way. It's her courage. And so that's sort of what I have in my mind. I want to be the boy Brené.
That is lovely. I so feel when you talk about this cumulative advantage and sort of Tim Ferriss's component of it, there's an element of you got to know what track you're going to go on, But what I loved about your journey, Mark, and what you expressed at the end, which is what resonated with me, was I didn't want to be on Oprah, per se, or at least that's not what you sought. You're open to it. Hey, listen, let's be pragmatic. Yeah.
Right. But
that's what you weren't necessarily open to it. So you're into the, I'm going to change, do different things, do different ways to achieve this idea of education, rather than just be the, in one kind of track, one channel, get to the biggest of the, whatever that category is. Mm-hmm. You've chosen, it seems with some element of solemnity, your approach, and inshallah, as we say, to
very much so. I was on an interview maybe a couple of years ago with one of the thought leaders in our field, who I'm sure you know, and we got into a discussion about Gary Vaynerchuk and all that he has millions and millions of followers. And he said, well, don't you want that life? Don't you want that? I said, not in the least, not in the least. He said, how could you not? How could you not? He said, don't you have like a certain amount of jealousy? I said, really? I said, I'm not kidding you. I really don't. I'm just really centered in where I am. I'm just really happy where I am right now. I don't want to be anybody else. I don't need a million followers. I don't want a million followers. I'm doing good work and people appreciate it. I'm helping people and it's just an amazing place to be. And one of the things, I'm sure you've seen this or experienced something like this too. You and I grew up in this corporate world. And we were what? We were focused on data and research and the numbers. And in the social media world, it's often not logic-led or data-led. It's guru-led. And the gurus in our field just have a disproportionate amount of power. You see these quotes, I call them the rainbow bombs, you know, the little quotes that you see on Facebook or LinkedIn, and people share them. And I wonder, do they even think about what they're sharing here? This doesn't even make sense. And we're sort of in this guru culture where people look up to the gurus. They want to be the gurus. They emulate the gurus. And it's like, it's almost like an alternative reality compared to the business world I grew up in, where at least the leaders in my company, they wanted to be challenged. They wanted the debate. They wanted to see the research. They wanted to see the numbers. There was no guru culture in a Fortune 100 company. It was a business culture. It was a professional culture. It was based on data and logic. And that seems to be totally missing in the marketing world sometimes.
Well, my mind goes to the world of kings with the title CEO, and how they seem to be always the guru with the best opinion in the room. So I certainly wanted to talk with you, Mark, about this notion of corporate world, because a lot of people who are listening are living in corporate world. And when I read your book, I felt like I was reading it the majority of the time. The majority of the account spoke to Minter, the entrepreneur, mm-hmm. and much less to me, the executive at L'Oreal. Mm-hmm. And this idea of the sonic boom, the great idea that you can sculpt and then knowing how to get the seam and push through. It felt like, you know, mm-hmm. you were master of your destiny at that point, and it's up to yeah. you to take command of that and then go for it. If I'm working mm-hmm. in a large organization, middle manager, or even CEO for that matter, of 100,000 yeah. employees, it feels like the yeah. cumulative advantage is more speaking to the brand and the corporation when you're versus the person as an entrepreneur. Talk me through what I just said.
Yeah, I think so. First of all, on a very high level, what is cumulative advantage? Cumulative advantage comes from sociological research that began in the 1960s that postulated if you have some small advantage over others in your field, that advantage could grow and grow really unabated without some sort of countervailing processes. This research has been applied to sports, entertainment, education, health, just about anything you can think of, but it hasn't really been connected to individual lives and businesses in a non-academic way. So that's the basic principle. So now you think about, okay, if I have some initial advantage with my, certainly my idea, my business, what about my department within my company? How does that work? What about my reputation in my company? And I used a couple of examples in my book where from both a personal level and a corporate level, how this was sort of applied. I gave the example of how I ended up being the global director of e-business for this Fortune 100 company, because when the internet was starting, I went to my boss and I said, I want an AOL subscription, $9 a month. I want to put it on my expense account because I think there are some business applications to the internet. And he wasn't wild about the idea, but he said, go ahead. And so I had been toying with these and I came up with an idea and it worked. And a few years later, when the company woke up and decided, oh, we need an e-business department, who shall we get to lead this? The natural choice was me, because I pursued my curiosity. That was my initial advantage. I pursued the curiosity and I hit a seam. The internet was opening, right? So then I created this department. Now, I was pushing water uphill, or maybe I was pushing bytes of information uphill, because I was in this big, more or less B2B company, and most of the business leaders didn't even know how to turn on a computer. And I was supposed to perpetuate an e-commerce solution when nobody even heard of it. It was a pioneering effort, really, in all of business. But I was cool. My department was cool. And we were able to have these little success stories that we were able to publicize, and the awareness grew and grew and grew. And soon people, they wanted to be on board because they heard about this internet thing and they wanted to be part of this. And I was able to attract the best talent in the company to keep this momentum going. So, I mean, yes, this can work on a personal level. It can work certainly on an entrepreneurial level. It can work for a career. It can work for a department within a company. Really, any place where you need to build momentum and outpace your competitors. We can see examples of cumulative advantage working in the world.
I love it. When I was reading it, I wanted to sort of shoot this out as like a random, fairly creative question, I hope. I'd love for you to comment the relationship between momentum, critical mass, momentum as in cumulative advantage, and critical mass, and inertia.
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the aspects of my research for this book is certainly looking at the work of Jim Collins with Good to Great and the flywheel, and I didn't want to recreate something that's already been done. And there is a connection, I think. The flywheel concept is what is the function or the activity in your business that sort of can drive you to the next level, And for me, it's a book, writing a book. I find that every time I write a book, I'm sure it's the same for you, it creates a new level of interest. It creates a new level of awareness. It creates a bigger audience. It creates more speaking engagements. It's the reason I'm talking to you today. Here I am spending amazing time with this amazing man And the excuse that we have today is because I wrote this book. So that's sort of the flywheel. Now, this would not have ever happened if I hadn't built that momentum behind the books. So there is a connection, I think, between inertia and critical mass. You know, maybe that's the next book I write is, you know, me with my arm around Jim Collins or something, linking up these ideas. But I never would have had the opportunity to establish a book as the driver of my flywheel if I didn't have the momentum in the first place. Mm-hmm. If I just wrote a book and it sat there, I wouldn't be here with you today. But I've written 9 books, and every book does better than the last book because now the momentum is going, and then it drives the flywheel in other ways for the business. So there is an interconnection there. I think that's a very keen observation. Do you feel the same way? Do you sort of see the same thing?
I do. I mean, this notion of getting to critical mass, I may be the sonic boom version of so many of our lives is when Oprah calls you or when you know, you're on TV, because mm-hmm. that just sort of catapults. Mass media still has the word mass in it. Whereas when you write a blog post and it's shared and viewed, it's great, but it's certainly not a couple of million people with an endorsement by some famous other person.
Yeah.
Which is a one-stop shop. You talk about how having 5 great people in this moment of sharing the influence story, you talk about the 5 different great people sharing is the right number. That's a critical mass number of reshares by influential people. So this notion of nodes of influential people pushing you out. And then once you get to the point where people are accepted, there's an accepted wisdom that comes out of Mark Schaefer.
And yes.
They bought 7 or 8 before. Well, this Scottish lady, she's bought the 9th one, right?
Yes. Right.
And so that's the cumulative advantage. But when in big business, mm-hmm. it's also, I feel like it's so much harder because you have so many, well, Martin Lindstrom, you quote him saying, that 84% of all businesses started from a random event.
Yeah.
At some level, once you've got the big business going, you're not starting it anymore, but you've got to start new ideas. And how do you bring in new?
You can't. I mean, you can't. it's really ridiculous and sad because I remember, you know, in my corporate days, if you didn't have a new business idea that was worth $100 million, there you go away, right? No hope. So big companies really aren't hotbeds of sparks of innovation like that. I think where the sparks of innovation are with big companies would be process improvements, cost control, better HR practices, better hiring practices, something like that. But it's hard to bring true breakthrough innovation into the corporate setting. And you know, that's the source of a lot of problems right now.
It's also the source of opportunities for entrepreneurs.
Yes, that's exactly right. That's what we call, you know, I talk in the book about the opportunity is when there's a fracture in the status quo. That is a fracture in the status quo. If there's a need out there, and these big companies don't pay attention to it, well, that's where we jump in and we become rich.
That becomes a seam.
Yep.
One of the dots, I love to connect dots. And so I was thinking you wrote about the constancy through crisis or the need for constancy.
Yeah.
And yet everyone else is talking about pivoting, agility, speed of change. So it was an interesting juxtaposition for me to think of constancy in the face of constant change.
Well, that's a great way to think about it, because I also say in the book that, look, whenever we're in a crisis, we need to look at the real world. We can't be stubborn. We can't be trying to sell horse and buggies when the automobile is being introduced. So, but we can't panic. And the advice that I'm giving business today, and I'm talking about this a lot is that you can't forget what brought you here. You can't forget what is your DNA. And your goal in this era of the pandemic is to get through 1 year. Can you get through 1 year? Do whatever it takes. At the beginning of the pandemic, like a lot of people, I thought, oh boy, I'm going to have a lot of time on my hands. I'm going to be able to do this. I'm going to be able to do this. And what we soon found out is that we didn't read a book a week. We didn't get the beach body that we wanted. We didn't learn a new language. The most heroic thing any of us can do right now is land on the other side intact, with our families intact, with our relationships intact, with our business intact. And to me, that just seems like something we can focus on is, can we get through this year? And then that's what I mean by constancy of purpose. It doesn't mean not pivoting. It means not panicking. It means just keep focused on your purpose. Keep focused on why people love you, and don't destroy that if you panic.
No, I totally get it. I mean, I like the way things go up in my mind. I'm like, oh, that's the dots connecting. One of the other, just to finish on, was you talk about connecting your present to your past. And I think that's related for me. Because if you can just go back to the shit problem that the founder of your organization went back and solved maybe 100 years ago, you're not going to reinvent the bicycle. Mm-hmm. However, that need to fix, the urgent, like, oh my God, I've got to fix this problem kind of feeling. Yeah. You need to tap into that history within your
past. For sure, for sure, for sure.
So, Mark, thank you for coming on. I had about a million more questions.
Aww.
That's just going to have to be channeled to people getting your book, Cumulative Advantage. Can you tell us, for those who don't know you, how to reach you, or at least follow what you read, because I'm sure you don't need a whole bunch of other people, but once they've read your book, sure, they can reach out and tell you how great it was.
Well, I would love that. I would love to hear that. That's the fire that keeps me going, for sure. Mm-hmm. You can find me at businessesgrow.com. Nobody can remember how to spell Schaefer, but most people can remember Businesses Grow. And you can find my blog, my podcast, my books, which really, at this point, I've written a book for just about every sort of stage of marketing you're in. And all my social media connections are there. So, yeah, I'd love for your listeners to connect with me and say hi.
Well, for me, it's been a pleasure. I love your laugh, Mark. I love the authenticity of your stories. I love your purpose. And I certainly have enjoyed reading this book, amongst others, that you've written. Well done, Mark. And thanks again.
Thank you, Minter. It's been a pleasure and an honor, as always.
Thanks for having listened to this episode of the Minter Dialogue Show. You'll find all the show notes and other blog posts on MinterDial.com. And if you enjoyed the show, please head over to Apple Podcasts to give a rating and review. And to finish, here's a song I wrote with Stephanie Singer, A Convinced Man.
I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust is a reason. Still, I won't tell the lie. I sit here passively, hope for your respect, anticipating the thrill of your intellect. Maybe I tell myself there's no use in me lying. I'm a convinced man, building an urge. I'm a convinced man. And I suffer, a convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, challenge my fate. I'm a convinced man. competition's innate. A convinced man in the arms of a woman despise revenges and struggle with deceit. Live for the challenge so life's not incomplete. What's wrong with challenge? I know soon we all die. I like the feel of a stranger tucked around me, precipitating the danger to feel free. Trust in my reason and let me show you why. I'm a convinced man, practicing my lines. I'm a convinced man, here in these confines. A convinced man, in the arms of a woman. I'm a convinced man, put me to the test. I'm a convinced man,
I'm ready for an arrest.
I'm a convinced man, in the arms of a woman.
How much do you understand the future of finance? I'm Jim Roos, a top 10 banking influencer and host of the podcast Banking Transformed, where we dive deeply into the rapidly evolving world of banking and financial technology. Join me as I interview industry experts, thought leaders, and innovators as they unravel the latest banking trends, disruptions, and game-changing technologies reshaping the world of finance. Redefine your understanding of the banking ecosystem. Subscribe now to Banking Transformed, available wherever you get your podcasts, and now available on YouTube.